House General Government Committee meeting. Thank you all for being here. I'm going to do a little adjustment here to the agenda and open first public hearing on House Bill 3067 and welcome Representative Boone to speak to us on her bill.
I'll try to make it through without Paul coming into a coughing fit. Good morning, Chair Berger and the rest of the committee. For the record, my name is Deborah Boone, House District 32 Representative. And I'm here today in support of House Bill 3067. I had this bill drafted at the request of some people in Tillamook County, where presently there is not an animal welfare shelter or facility, and it's only one of three counties in the state that does not have a shelter facility. A nonprofit board has been formed, the Tillamook Animal Shelter, Inc., and they're doing what they can to address the problem. One way is to raise not only the money, but public awareness for a shelter and to establish the county as an animal control district. The law currently does not allow for that, so this bill simply adds a cue to a long list of different kinds of districts you can form in Section 1 of the bill, and it reads, adds animal control to services counties may provide by service districts. They're ready to form this district, and I wanted to just give you a tiny bit of history. In 1982, Tillamook County faced a severe drop in timber revenues, and that resulted in the elimination of the county animal control program. Since Tillamook County presently does not enforce animal licensing, animal control violations, or animal rights, the creation of an animal control district is absolutely critical to establishing a legal basis by which the county can begin to address its animal welfare problem. One local vet has indicated that many people will call to find out where they can take unwanted pets or a found animal. And this results in a network of community foster homes for unwanted pets, which is a good interim step, but it's not the long-term fix. This bill would allow the option of creating a district, an option that does not currently exist, and it would not force a special district, but just allows for the creation of one if the voters so choose. I would appreciate your support, and if you have any questions, I'll try to answer them. The people who asked for this bill were unable to come today, and so I told them that I would speak on their behalf, too. So.
Thank you, Representative. Questions for Representative Boone? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Is there anyone else? No one else has indicated to sign up on this bill.
I did hear from Gordon Foltz, AOC.
Who's coming forward at my invitation. Go ahead, Gordon.
Chair Berger, members of the committee, for the record, Gordon Foltz, Association of Oregon Counties. We've reviewed this. This is just a permissive piece of legislation that we have no problem with. So just wanted to go on record.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you both very much. And I will close public hearing on House Bill 3067 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2649. Carol, would you please start us out?
I'd be happy to. Slightly out of order.
Yeah, sorry.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2649 deals with posting of budget summaries for municipal corporations, cities, counties, and special districts. There was some confusion over exactly what this bill would do, and so having talked to the sponsor's office and also to legislative council, I think I'm pretty clear now on what the intent is. You may or may not be aware that local governments now are required to publish a budget summary at the time they're going through their budget proceedings, usually in May or June, in what the statute calls one or more newspapers of general circulation in that jurisdiction. For a small government, there are three options. They can either publish in a newspaper, they can mail by first class postage to every street address in their jurisdiction, a copy of the budget summary, or they can hand deliver to each address in their jurisdiction. But they in some way must get this word directly out to their constituents. What this bill would do is add a fourth option using new technology whereby a local government could post its budget summary on a website and then purchase a notice, yeah, again in that one or more newspapers or general circulation that lists the title of the budget summary and also the uniform resource locator that we know better as a URL, so that constituents could find it on the website. And with that background, I would suggest you go to a nice list of people who'd like to speak on this bill.
Thank you, Karen. I'd like to first ask Representative Barnhart, who is the sponsor and who is here, to come
knock in on me.
Come forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Phil Barnhart. I represent Central Lane and Linn County in the Oregon House of Representatives. And I appreciate that summary because I think it does summarize very well what the bill contains. I have proposed an amendment, which is the dash ones that you should have available, which adds something which I thought was understood but wasn't in the bill, and that is that in the event that a person wants it, they could contact the municipal corporation, and the municipal corporation would have to mail them a paper copy of the budget summary, so that those who did not have access to the internet could still get a copy of the budget summary and do it that way. I've written a series of bills this session on public notice. I consider public notice to be a key item when we're talking about developing a good system in keeping the public informed about the state government and about other government activities. I fully believe that the better the public is informed about our activities and the activities of other levels of government, the better decisions members of the public can make as voters when it comes to budgets and taxation and other things of that sort. And this bill is intended to improve public notice. There are a number of things you can do on websites in terms of allowing for information to be understandable and clear that are very hard to do in a fine print newspaper advertising, which is the method that most of these municipalities use at the current time. I believe also that this bill would increases the accountability of the various agencies because it would have the effect of reducing their cost. An ad in a newspaper with the title takes up considerably less room than an ad that contains the entire budget summary. It improves streamlining in government and efficiency in government. We have a new technology available. It's only been available. The web has only existed since about 1993, if I recall correctly. So it's only 12 years old. By this time, though, the vast majority of households in the United States and even in Oregon have access in some form or another to the Internet. Certainly the majority of people who are interested in news and paying attention to the news have such access. The kinds of things that we will be able to do and are able to do now as e-government slowly develops, I believe is going to significantly improve our capacity to communicate with the public. This bill is one very small part of the development of that process. And with that, I think I'll stop and answer any questions you might have.
Questions from the committee. Representative Galizio.
Good morning, Representative.
Good morning, sir.
Did you get my email? I'm sorry, I'm really tired. One question and one observation and then question. Posting on an internet website, boy, there sure are a lot. So I don't know. I haven't read all the specifics about it just says posting on a website. So where, you know, which website? And then my second question is, it seems like a lot of people have enormous amount of time on their hands and they do interesting things on the web. So if I really didn't like a particular agency, I could set up a wonderful fake website and have all kinds of incredible expenditures, junkets to Tahiti, et cetera, et cetera. So what about that?
You know, thank you, Representative Galizio. Madam Chair, Representative Galizio, there always are issues around web security that I think have a potential for to arise. Most municipalities, school districts, counties, and other municipalities currently have their own websites under their own names, either using the standard nomenclature of the .or.us nomenclature for describing their website in the URL system, or their own websites using an EDU or some other similar designation. So I think that to some extent, at least, that's obviated. There's no question that there are ongoing security problems with the way the web is handled. These issues, I think, are well beyond the scope of this bill. But I can tell you that as they come up, the large companies that handle the development of web servers, that handle the security of computing systems, are more and more on top of these kinds of problems. I'm frankly not aware of websites in Oregon of government entities that have been taken over in the way you suggest, although I know it's been done. It's certainly been done in a number of places. There's nothing to say that it couldn't happen in Oregon, but I think that as time goes along, these kinds of things are less and less likely to occur.
Thank you. Said response, Representative Cameron.
Good morning, Representative. just a question on what's being published in the newspaper. Is the URL obviously is being published where I can go? But is there a phone number being published to call to request a copy being mailed? In the amendment, it just says that I can call the agency. So now do I have to try to figure out what agency and where's the phone number to call? And one more question. Obviously, it says, and to have a copy mailed, is there an option to have it faxed if we're trying to keep costs down here?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cameron, my intention in drafting this was that the notice would include the address and telephone number of the municipality where the information could be obtained. As I look at the amendment and at the original bill, I see that that information is missing. And if the bill is to go forward, I think that that ought to be added as an additional amendment so that it's clear that the advertisement would contain the title, that is the name of the budget summary, so people know what it is that the government is advertising about.
Mm-hmm.
That it include the URL so that people who can get on the web can go directly to it, and that it include the address and telephone number where other people can go to request the information. I would certainly not have any objection to including in the requirement that those who ask that it be faxed to them, that it be faxed instead.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
Isn't that what the amendment says?
Well, I think that the testimony is that within the amendment, it only specifies that that would be on the website and not in published reports. Am I correct, Representative, that in your reading of your proposed amendment, the telephone number and address are included, but they are included in the website, not necessarily in published accounts?
Well, at this moment, Madam Chair, I'm not certain, but intention that the final bill would include a requirement that that be published in the notice in the newspaper.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Representative Barnhart, you and I have discussed this pretty in detail. I'm for this bill, and what it does, it demonstrates that we want to look at efficiency in government, because if you take the amount of money that is spent, I know what it costs to run an ad in our local paper, and I believe a full-page ad is in the tune of almost $2,000. So therefore, you have to publish this out, and what this also does, not only twofold of efficiency, but more importantly, in my opinion, it was an unfunded mandate in the first place, which we didn't have laws at that time to circumvent that process. But I think that this is a good way to streamline and, more importantly, to save money. And let's take about education. Let's look at some of the school districts we have. They're struggling with getting monies, so this is another tool that they can put monies towards the classrooms. Same with your municipalities. They can take this money and use it for other things other than just feeding the local newspaper with that particular budgetary process that is required now by law to publish. So I'm all for this.
Thank you very much,
thank
Representative
you,
Barnhart. In keeping with our desire to respect the folks from a long ways away, I'm going to ask Linda Warren from Rogue Community College to come forward with Lori Satenspiel. They've signed up together, and since she's indicated she's come from a long ways and Rogue is a long ways, I'm going to ask you to come up first.
Thank you. Chair Berger, members of the committee, I'm Lori Satenspiel, Government Relations for the Oregon Community College Association, which represents the 17 community colleges in Oregon and 330,000 Oregonians. We're here in support today of 2649. I would also like to note on the 2649 that Representative Esquivel is a co-sponsor. We started the process down the road with this bill as well and found that Representative Barnhart had already got out in front of us, and Esquivel signed on to the bill, so that it doesn't note that. And I just wanted to be sure that it's noted. We've been asked throughout the interim many times by legislators to, how can we help you? How can we help you save money? Well, this is one of them. Pretty simple. This would allow the community college to publish the budget summary on the website with the URL in the paper. Currently, we've got costs at the community colleges all over the board. We range from $484 to the top end with Rogue at $6,000 to publish. And Linda is going to speak to that issue. As the colleges face continuing reductions, and we're looking at possible ways to save money, increase access to training and education for Oregonians, this bill would help us. Today, with the technology and advancing Internet access, House Bill 2649 brings the budget process to the communication medium of today. Opportunity to publish the budget allows more Oregonians to have access to bring a greater level of transparency and accountability to our local budget process. And I'd like to turn it over to Linda. She is Chief Financial Officer and Dean of College Services for Rogue Community College.
Thank you, Lori. Chair Berger and representatives, thank you very much for allowing me the opportunity to speak in support of House Bill 2649 to allow us to publish our budget information on the web. As Lori mentioned, the cost for us for this year would be approximately $6,000. Between 2003 and 2004, our cost more than doubled. We were looking in 2003 about a little over $2,000. In 2004, it went to over $5,000. While $6,000 of a $27 million budget may not seem like a whole lot, as mentioned, with what else we could do with that money, $6,000 would allow us to offer approximately 3 more sections for the citizens of our district and serve approximately 60 teach 60 citizens in classes rather than spending it to advertise our budget. Rogue Community College has been using the Internet for years to provide access to the citizens of our district. Our detailed audit and budget reports for the last 3 years are on our website, They do have people that we have people look at those. It provides a more detailed analysis than what you get in the newspaper. People can actually go in and see details by departments rather than just a summary by funds. We feel that House, we also published last year the EDs that are required to be published in the newspaper. We also published them on our website, and we had approximately almost 300 people look at those in the last year. We feel that House Bill 2649 takes a necessary step to save community colleges, school districts, and local governments money in these difficult financial times, while at the same time ensures our citizens have access to our information. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yes, Representative Buckman.
How long do you keep the budget information once it's posted up until the next budget cycle comes up?
Actually, Chair Berger and Representative Buckley, to answer that question, we actually keep it on for 3 years.
My gosh.
Linda, for my benefit, a clarification of you currently, everything that you publish, you also post.
This past year, we posted, we also published what we posted in the newspaper, Chair Berger, but prior to that, even, we were posting the detailed budget, the budget book that the board and the budget committee is given each year, which is about, you know, this thick. We publish that information on our website that people can access, you know, personnel information, department information. Yeah.
Okay.
So it's even more detailed than what's posted.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you
for coming. You know, Representative Cameron.
Yeah, just for the record, that in that amendment, I was just speaking with Representative outside, in that amendment, it does ask that the address and the phone number be published.
It does.
So we just need to worry about the fax issue.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome, Leroy Jorgensen of the Oregon Newspaper Publishers. Am I close?
Yes. Yes.
Thank you. Please come forward.
Madam Chairperson, I'm Leroy Jorgensen, members of the committee. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. Our headquarters is in Tigard, and we're here to speak concerning our interests in this bill. I'd like, first of all, if I could, to let Dave Weston, who is a publisher, address the bill, and he has some very pointed comments on it.
Good morning, Madam Chair, distinguished representatives. I'm Dave Weston. I'm the publisher of the Polk County Itemizer Observer. It's a weekly newspaper with more than a century of chronicling the activities of Polk County residents, especially those in Independence, Monmouth, and Dallas. And I wish to address the matter of providing the public with information about the public with information about the budgets of local cities and districts. Local governments, as you are aware, are suffering many of the same problems facing you as legislators and facing the state in general. And we see belt tightening and budget cutting processes nearly everywhere we look. For those involved in community newspapers, any talk of reducing the level of local service hits home very quickly. It may be because we have children or even grandchildren in our schools that are faced with fewer teachers, fewer course options. And these local schools may range from kindergarten through community colleges. I happen to be kind of partial to schooling and education, so I'm going to look at it more from that standpoint than from other municipalities. But it certainly applies in all cases. A clear picture of revenues and expenses is important when we're trying to help people understand the changes that are occurring right now as we face these tight times. And my experience as a newspaper publisher since 1972 tells me that even in this age of information saturation, which we have with the internet and a million other means of getting information, it's the local newspaper that generally winds up legitimizing local happenings. When I say legitimizing local happenings, I'm talking about a lot of things. Even when we have a weekly newspaper, people wait until the newspaper comes out to decide, did this really happen or not? Is it just something I heard or did it really occur? And so we're providing a lot of credibility We may not be first with the news, but we're providing a lot of credibility with what we publish. We're providing that credibility for both the news side and also for the advertising side. And that is really a vital issue when it comes to budgets. We also provide a verifiable document with everything. We're providing you with a legal affidavit that is a sworn testimony that this publication actually occurred at the time we said it occurred. And when we publish something, you can see the time that this was published. It's on the page in which it's published. It's in the notice in which it's published. And that's not subject to change. It's frozen in time. A lot of times we find that the most interested citizens are our older citizens. They're a primary readership for our local newspapers. They're not our only readers, thank heavens, but a very high proportion of the senior population reads its local newspaper. They trust what they see in print, as they should. Last week a fellow came into my office and he's running for school board. He finds his information and his inspiration both for this from the Itemizer Observer, not the internet. Our letters to the editor are lively. Even this week, and it's a quiet time, we don't have elections going on, a lot of things that get people riled up, we had letters spread across 3 pages of our paper. Topics covered a wide range of areas and interests. People choose to discuss issues in a newspaper because they know what they say will be looked at over and over. Their words gain credibility by being published. Right now, local governments, schools especially, need all the support and understanding they can get. A time of cutbacks is a time when the public must feel it is getting the whole truth, nothing but the truth. The public has a high degree of trust in its local newspapers. The relatively small amount it costs to publish an already condensed form of the budget document provides that opportunity for openness and honesty. It reassures the public that things aren't being hidden. It reassures the public where the public is looking now. The local district is buying into the credibility of the publication as well as it's using its own credibility. It's delivering information to the hands and eyes of a public that may or may not have access to a computer and the internet. For those of us raised with newsprint and printer's ink, it's reassuring to find information in that format. It may not be granite, but it is unchanging. It's an independent medium. It's not under the control of those providing the information. In closing, I thank you, Madam Chair and Committee, for your time and attention. I urge you, avoid shortchanging our schools and local government organizations by being penny wise and pound foolish here. Be assured that the information gets to the people who want it and gets to them clearly and honestly. Keep local budgets where local eyes are most likely to find them, in the local newspaper. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Weston. Questions? Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Weston, just out of curiosity, the process that would take place with a taking out an ad in your publication, would you do a fact check on that ad if a budget summary was submitted by your school district that said, here's our budget summary and here's the ad we want to buy? Would someone on your staff then go through to make sure that was an accurate budget summary before the ad was printed?
The budget summaries are prepared by the school districts or by the local entities. We're not going to fact check those summaries. As a fact, we cover the news and we'll be looking at them. In fact, every legal notice that goes through our paper I look at personally, and I'm pretty much aware of numbers I should see and where I should see them. So if I see a discrepancy, for any number of legal notices, I will call the party providing it. It may be a foreclosure notice or something else, and if I see something, I'll always call it. But it's an informal process. It's not something that we're going to say that we're fact-checking this, because our source is that source. How would we check the facts besides going to that source? But what we've done is we've frozen that document at that time. It's not subject to further change by unseen hands.
Thank you.
Your news department will look into it.
Further questions?
Yeah.
Yes, Representative.
Well, isn't this something that should be covered as a news story?
Oh, and
so
it
would
is.
Anyway. I mean, I
it it's going to be covered, and it always is covered. We cover the entire budget process as a rule. The document that comes out, the final document that comes out, really comes out at the end of that process, and it's there. But it's something that we're not going to publish the document. We're going to pick and choose in the news what we do, and try to call attention to specific things like that. The document itself is something that the reader can look at, and it may raise questions. It's a very condensed summary that is being published now. We're not publishing, as a rule, the entire document, as we just heard Rogue Community College is doing on its internet site, and that's a wonderful use for that, and a wonderful, wonderful way to do it. But we publish a budget summary as provided by the laws and regulations in the state, and that summary may raise questions that they're following up on, but certainly gives the appearance that the school board or the city is forthcoming with what's going on. It's worth something from the standpoint of marketing the district, and I hate to see that lost, because I think it's one of those things that could cost a lot at this point, particularly in terms of losing some confidence in people we need support from.
A different question. What do you estimate the revenue loss to be for, let's say, the Oregon Independent newspapers?
Oh, I don't have that number. I'm sorry.
Well, actually, as far as the budget documents go, for virtually all the budgets that we publish, which would include any number of school districts, fire protection districts, cities, county, and everything else, our paper, which is a weekly newspaper serving Polk County, is going to be looking at something on the same order as what we just heard mentioned from Rogue College. The total for all the budgets, which I'm going to guess we're talking approaching $100 million of public budgets in those, maybe even excess, is going to be in that same order as what we heard from Rogue. And so no one district is hit with particularly large amounts. I think about the largest were some cities that paid right around $1,000. School districts are running generally half that.
So just to give us an idea of that, what percentage of overall ad revenue that newspaper receives, what percentage are we talking about here?
It's a small percentage. This isn't a life and death matter. It's really a mutual benefit for getting the story completely told and building, I think, credibility for the institutions.
Thank you. Further questions? Mr. Jorgensen.
Thank you. I'd like to pick up just on general idea of public notice.
Could you state your name for the record first, please?
I'm Leroy Jorgensen, Executive Director of the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. my interest is addressing the general concept of public notice. And I'd like to start out by saying that this concept has been developing for over a century, and so there is a great deal of intricacies of how that whole system operates. We certainly do support the idea of putting things onto the internet. In fact, to indicate our support, we are asking all of the newspapers to upload all of their legal notices onto a website called www.publicnotice-or.com. This has been in operation for over 2 years, and we have had many newspapers uploading all of their legal notices onto that site. And we do this at no additional cost to government. So that if we can get the cooperation of all the newspapers, which we don't readily have, all of those notices will be available. We keep track of how it's used. For example, the week of March 8th to 14th, there were 3,445 page views delivered to people who came to that website. We also have a subscription available to them. It costs them nothing. We just ask them to identify themselves and say what kinds of notices you're interested in. And we have 204 people doing that. Whenever a notice comes onto the board that relates to their interest, an email is sent to them so that they can immediately see what's been uploaded and see what those notices are. As a result of that, this past year we sent 39,730 notices to people who have subscribed to our board. So we do keep intricate records of who's using it, where they're coming from, and how often, and how many unique visitors, etc. We think that the Internet has tremendous potential. We're just beginning to see the potential that it has. So we do support it immensely. Newspapers have been spending a lot of money on Internet development, and we're very interested in seeing that happen. But as I indicated, there has been a century of development of public notice. The courts refer to notices in the newspaper as constructive notice. Those of you who are lawyers will know a lot more about that than I do. But it indicates that there is some kind of ability to show that that notice appeared and was available to the people who are being affected by it. And courts have questioned, there have been cases that go to courts to question whether or not notice has been given. There are a number of restrictions on newspapers in order to be able to carry legal notices. For example, they have to be general circulation, they have to contain news, the newspaper must be of a minimum size, so big, so many pages, etc. It must have paid subscribers for the previous 12 months, and it must be independently audited, published at least weekly. And then when those notices are put into the newspaper, it has to be put in that newspaper that serves the county, city, or district that is of interest to that municipality. The type size must be of a size large enough to be easily read. I received email from another press association, and I have to tell him, please make your type size bigger. I can't read your stuff. And that's a problem. So there has to be some kind of indication of the controls over the notices that are appearing. And then we have to supply an affidavit verifying that the notice was published. Now in the statutes, there's 316 references to public notice. And most of them refer to about eight ideas: advertisements for bids, announcements, a bond sale, elections, foreclosure, hearing, a meeting, a sheriff's sale. As indicated earlier, there are different ways of providing that notice. U.S. mail is one. Posting in public places another. Local newspapers. For bond issues, there's national newspapers. So we're saying that if we go down this road, and certainly there needs to be progress down this road, there has to be some way to verify that the ad was on the Internet. Assurance that it was published, and it was published without change from the time period it started until it ended. Some way to verify that it appeared. It was published in a timely manner. Records must be kept showing that it was published, that can withstand court scrutiny. Verification that the website is credible, as was pointed out earlier. It can be a fictitious website. Let's make sure that that website is credible and recognized by the community. And it's made available to the local citizens, indicated by the original idea of publishing it in the newspaper, and have an independent audit, not just the government unit itself, but some other entity verifying that, yes, that local government did do that notice. That's the conclusion of my notes. I'd be glad to respond to any questions.
Questions, Mr. Jorgensen? Thank you very much. Thank you both for coming and speaking to us. And now might be the most appropriate time to enter into the record an email that I received from Jeb Bladeen, the publisher of the McMinnville News Register Guard, and our committee administrator will distribute copies for the record. He was unable to attend today, but his testimony will be entered into the record for all members of the committee.
I'd like to ask Bill Penhollow and David Battenberg. Barenberg, sorry. I don't have my glasses on. I have two sets here, but neither were on my face when I was reading.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, and I actually have to take mine off so I can read. I think that I need a second set. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. I'm Dave Barenberg from the League of Oregon Cities, and being distributed to the committee are some testimony and with some documents appended that I'll talk about in just a moment. I want to agree with concur with the testimony given by our community college colleagues that, one, the existing statutes do require local governments to incur additional costs and do stifle some innovation or ways to try to get information out to citizens in more creative ways with greater detail and in a more usable form. And to buttress that point, if you just turn to the second few pages of appended to the testimony, these are the recommended forms from the Department of Revenue for local governments to publish the information in newspapers. And if you flip through them, they are not particularly the most accessible form or useful in portraying what a government does or how the funds are being expended. I'm sort of a junkie and like this stuff. And when I've seen this in the newspaper, published in my local newspaper, my eyes seem to glaze over, and that's from somebody who really does like the numbers. What this bill does is provides an additional option. It doesn't provide a requirement. It allows communities and governmental entities that want to try different ways of reaching their constituency too, and to try to save some money in the process. And it also allows communities and other and governmental entities to continue with the status quo. And we think that we really do want to have an involved constituency in our budget process and deliberations. We do have citizens appointed to our budget committee. We do want to make this information available, but in a form that really does connect with people and not just a column of numbers that only an accountant can know. With that, I'm happy to take any questions, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Questions?
Go ahead. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Penhall with the Association of Oregon Counties. We also support the bill 2649 and the amendments that were presented to you this morning. Agree that this is a good alternative to what is currently required in the statutes. Find that not all counties will take advantage of this, because not all counties at this point have a website available. Some of the smaller counties do not. But feel that with the advent of the internet superhighway that we have available to us, that this is a mechanism that many people can use and take advantage of that might otherwise, as Mr. Barenberg points out, not spend the time to study the details in as published in their newspaper. The costs, I think, have been spoken to this morning from what I have discovered in counties of medium size, and I'm thinking of Linn County and Polk County and Union County across the state. They're spending anywhere from $1,000 to $2,500 a year publishing. But this would provide them the opportunity of getting that information to their constituents in another form if they so agreed. And as Mr. Barenberg pointed out, as you know, the budget committees for local governments are made up of an equal number of public citizens. So our budget committees in most counties are made up of three county commissioners and three people from the community. And they go through the budget. They recommend the budget that is published here. And I think those people can, with this additional authority, make a good judgment on how best to get the information out in their community. So we would encourage the committee to support this legislation and with the amendment. And thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning.
Questions? Yes,
While many seniors are certainly internet savvy, what about the argument that a lot of folks who do prefer print, they might be left out, or low-income people?
Madam Chair, Representative Galizio, we have supportive of the intent of what Representative Barnhart said of publishing, you know, phone number or address to make information available. Frankly, we like it when citizens ask for information and would, you know, relish the opportunity to provide it to those who are interested in a more detailed form. So allowing those through publication in the newspaper who aren't of the address and contact information, we think would get to that concern.
Madam Chair, if I may respond as well, Representative Galizio, a couple of points. Number one, with inquiry, then the individual can be directed to various points within the county or within their city where they can find the complete document and get additional information, as Mr. Barenberg pointed out, with regard to the budget. It's normally filed at the libraries. It would be at the county courthouse, city hall, other places where that information would be available, as well as individuals that didn't have access could request that copies be mailed to them, and that could be accommodated. The other advantage that I failed to mention earlier about using the websites that cities and counties and other local governments have established is there's other very important and valuable information that can be found there that's important to the citizens of the community. Just one example, as you heard earlier, is the annual audit that is performed on all local government jurisdictions. That's something that is as important, I believe, to the citizenry as the budget or the proposed budget. So, thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Sumner, you had a question.
Gentlemen, as I read House Bill 2649, to me it's saying it allows certain municipalities and corporations to use the internet to publish their budgets, etc. It does not mandate it. Is that true? In other words, if cities, counties, whatever, choose to continue using the newspaper, that's perfectly all right. Is that
Madam
correct?
Chair, Representative Sumner, very clearly it says that they may use any one or more of the following methods to publish that information.
Thank you.
I have a question since you're sitting in the chair. Did you indicate, Mr. Penhall, that there are counties that do not have the capability of posting some of this information?
Madam Chair, yes. We have some counties that have not established websites at this time. We're working with some of the few remaining that do not have websites in helping them get websites up and operating. One of the major concerns that we find with the small counties is finding someone to manage the website for them. Not only, I mean, establishing, but managing. Think of a Wheeler County where the full-time county officials or the county judge, the county treasurer, the county assessor, they really don't have staff to handle those things. So that is a problem, and a few of the smaller counties, and I would guess smaller cities, do not have websites.
Then I would submit that it sort of speaks to this issue of the cost savings within that was brought up, which is there is a cost to internet posting along with any newspaper requirements. There is a cost to the agencies to, and some certainly of the bigger ones, and I don't want to get into those numbers, okay, but I just would submit that it's, when we're talking cost, there is a cost there too.
Madam Chair, if I may respond, and then Mr. Barenberg may wish to. Yes, and the costs that I quoted were not the costs associated with the labor of putting these documents together and preparing them. It's just the cost of publishing. So most of that cost would be incurred in either event.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just to respond, and I think those communities too would, who are looking at their capabilities, would just choose to do it the way that it's been done rather than having to go to the Internet.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions, Representative Esquivel?
Yes, it's this bill brings a choice. And you can't, in this state, we're so diversified that we have rural and very rural, and we have urbanization in the metro area, as well as the Willamette Valley and on the I-5 corridor and Bend, that have a substantial amount of population. Most of the populated areas do, in fact, have a website. Most counties do. Some do not. Example, we have a situation, and this is the way we have to look at these things. And that's why it's not a mandate. And that is, believe it or not, in the state of Oregon, we're still required to do microfilm backup. Well, that's like waging nuclear war with a bear skin and a stone knife at that point, because that's very archaic. But when we went and wrote a bill on it to stop that, if you wanted to, because there's some counties that can't afford or have the ability to go ahead and scan into a computer and do a backup. We're doing the same thing here. We're giving an opportunity and a choice to our local governments and to our municipalities. There's 240 cities, I believe. There's 36 counties. There's 17 community colleges and I don't know how many universities. Plus, look at all your districts. Look at your fire districts. Look at your water districts. Look at your irrigation districts. For heaven's sakes, we're talking maybe in excess of 1,000 government entities here that will have the ability, and a lot of them have the website anyway, to have the choice of whether to participate or not to participate. That's what's good. It's a local choice issue.
Is there a question in there? All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Thanks. And we have one more testifier. A cleanup is Mr. John Phillips. Mr. John Phillips from the Department of Revenue, who gets to have sort of the final word unless he brings up a new thing that we didn't know.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Phillips with the Department of Revenue. The Department of Revenue does not oppose this bill. I just wanted to bring up a few points of clarification. The department administers local budget law, the Local Budget Law Act, which this statute is a part of. And so that's why we are here. This section of statute that's being amended by 2649 actually is the definition section of the beginning of that act, and it describes the how part of publication. It talks about newspaper, hand delivery, mailing, but it doesn't talk about the what part of the question. The what part of the question is answered in the handout that I just gave you, which is 294.416, and it identifies four items in terms of what is published. And those four things are the summary of the budget, the method of accounting if it's changed, the notice of where citizens can get a copy of the budget, and finally it also describes it's the notice of the hearing. So each local government, roughly 1,500 in Oregon, have to hold a hearing as part of their budget process. And this notice provides the notice of the time, date, place, accessibility of that hearing. So what I would just ask the committee to consider is two points of clarification for this bill. The first is the one that Representative Galizio pointed out, and that is that an Internet site is not clear to us where this is to be published. So working with local governments to identify where this site is, you know, a little more clarity to that, and that's on line 33 of page 3. And the other point is on line 35 of page 3, where it specifically says the what. It says the title of the budget summary, but it doesn't list the other items. And so My suggestion would be either twofold. One, remove the title of the budget summary so that it's so that the local governments will know that when they know what it is they're posting, they'll go to 294.416 where it lists what's to be published, or include all of the requirements in this statute in the definition. So I would be happy to work with anybody in coming up with language for that, but I think that would help clarify for local governments what it is they're publishing.
Thank you. Ms. Phillips, questions? I think it's clear he's brought some things that need work within this proposal. Any questions, Ms. Phillips?
Okay.
Thank you, John, very much.
I have more questions for
you. Okay. Okay. At this time, thank you all for coming on this matter, and I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2649 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2916. Kara?
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2916 eliminates the requirement for public libraries to maintain actual operating expenditures for library services to remain eligible for state financial assistance. If this bill sounds familiar, it's because it was originally before us a legislative council draft, and the committee chose to submit it as under its name as the sponsor. Just to review that quickly, state law now requires that public libraries maintain a consistent funding level, and what is happening is as cities and counties that have libraries services within their budgets are looking at reduced budgets and trying to stretch their costs to all of their operations, that libraries are sometimes getting a smaller budget in one year than they had the year prior. And so this examines that requirement and how we might be able to change that. I would remind you that when we were in Medford last week on Thursday evening, that you received testimony on this bill, and it will become part of this record. For those of you who weren't in the hearing, I'll get a copy of it to you, but Ann Billiter, who is the Children and Youth Librarian, did submit testimony earlier. And with that,
thank you. I'm going to ask a panel to come forward, Nan and B.J. Quinlan and Jim Schlepke. We've got a lot of librarians in the.
Yeah. I got to read this story.
The question was, are they going to read us a story? And I can tell you that B.J. Quinlan has read a lot of stories to a lot of people.
I can tell a lot.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Nan Heim, representing the Oregon Library Association. I'm not actually a librarian, but with me today are B.J. Quinlan, the children's librarian from Salem Public Library, and she does read a story fabulously, and Jim Shepke, our state librarian, and we're all here in support of House Bill 2916. I just want to explain briefly, or perhaps confess, that actually it was the Oregon Library Association that originally requested this provision in statute that we are now asking to be repealed. It was a number of years ago when state aid to public libraries first began, and our purpose in requesting it was to try to ensure that local governments did not take state monies and replace local monies with the grants. And what we found over the years is that, in fact, what happens, in fact, local taxpayers and local governments have been generally very supportive of public libraries, and that most cuts in public library funding are because of local economic conditions. And so public libraries end up losing their state ready-to-read grants just when they could use them the most. And in the last 10 years, we've come to the legislature twice and asked that this provision be temporarily suspended. And in fact, right now it's temporarily suspended because we asked last session. And so during the interim, we decided that the time had come to ask for it to be repealed. And with that, I'm going to have BJ talk about ready-to-read grants and why they are so useful.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Youth Services Manager at Salem Public Library and have been for 23 years. In those 23 years, the best we've ever heard as a director from the city is prepare a hold-the-line budget. Those are in the good years. So in order to increase services to our children and youth at Salem Public Library, the Ready to Read grant has been invaluable. And I wanted to mention just a few of the things that we've done with the Ready to Read money. We've done a lot of collection development, especially in the areas where children are doing homework. Oregon history, sciences, health, drug issues. We've increased our collection of materials to correspond with the areas that the Salem-Keizer School District is studying, because we have 45 elementary schools, we have 15 middle schools. We have a lot of schools drawing on one public library. So collection development has been very important. We, in youth services, are very, very influenced by the scientific research that's been done on early brain development, and really feel it's imperative to get the word out to parents, to daycare providers, and teen mothers. And we have used our Ready to Read money to allow us to do classes and workshops for these groups to tell them how important early learning is and what they can be doing to foster best practices for brain development for babies. We have been able to keep up with technological changes by getting computers that are up to date. A lot of children, contrary to some opinion, don't have access to computers outside of the school day, and yet are required to do typewritten reports, do PowerPoint presentations now, and the public library is someplace that they can come in and use computers that we bought with Ready to Read money that enable them to prepare their material for school so that they can keep up with their more affluent peers. We have a children's discovery room at the library, which is a hands-on interactive learning area. It's kind of unusual for a public library. But when budget cuts were really, really strong in 1996 because of the legislation, we were able to keep that room open and staff it because of Ready to Read money. It allowed us to do that. We've done a tremendous amount of programming for youth, everything from infant lap sit all the way through teen programs for our middle schoolers because of our Ready to Read money. For example, we did a Boogie Woogie concert series for a number of years that was paid for with Ready to Read money, where we brought in professional singers for the six and under set. We do book discussion groups that have been started because of our Ready to Read money. We do programs for youth on in-service days, on holidays. Our summer reading club has been affected in a large way. And the Ready to Read money has helped us grow. We have over 5,000 children now who sign up for summer reading. And it's because Ready to Read has allowed us to really focus on getting those kids reading during the summer to keep up their skills. We also benefit because our regional library system, the Chemeketa Cooperative Regional Library Service, receives Ready to Read money as well. And we've been able to work cooperatively as 18 public libraries with children's librarians doing projects that are much bigger than any one of us, including Salem, could possibly have done without this Ready to Read backing. So I would just like to put in my vote for disbanding this maintenance of effort, because it does truly hurt libraries the most when they can least afford to be hurt.
Thank you. Questions? Mr. Shepke.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Shepke. I'm director of the State Library. I'm here today to testify in support of this bill. The State Library Board actually passed a motion at their January 28th meeting in support of this concept of repealing the maintenance of effort provision for the Ready to Read grant. And the reasoning that the board had in doing that is very much what you've already heard. We really understand that public libraries are facing budget problems in this state like never before, and many libraries have already had their budgets reduced this year or at risk or are at risk for having their budgets reduced next year. We're aware of a number of ballot measures that were on the ballot last year that weren't successful in places like Clackamas County and here in Salem. So when you look at the big picture, the board's feeling is that it's much more important for every library to get a ready-to-read grant than to continue with the maintenance of effort provision. So we very much support the repeal, and we urge your support of this bill.
Thank you. I have one question, and I think, BJ, you're probably in the best position to answer this, but what are the sideboards on the ready-to-read program that ensure us that these state funds are used in the manner prescribed? Since we are kind of taking off a sideboard, what are the sideboards that are in place that assure us that you're not just replacing?
Madam Chair, I would defer to Jim Shepard.
Okay, that's fine.
Madam Chair, we have a very careful process. Every library must apply for a grant. It's not we don't just send checks to libraries. Every library must make application. Every library must indicate what they're going to do with their grant, and they have to give some performance measures that they're going to use for their grant. And then there's a follow-up report that tells us whether they've been successful with their project. So I think all those things contribute to a situation where we don't see that local money's being replaced with the state dollars. These are projects that improve service beyond the status quo in these libraries.
Thank you. Further questions, Representative Buckley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Shippey, what are the size of the grants, roughly?
Madam Chair, Representative, in the past year, we gave out 117 grants, and there were 124 libraries eligible, so nearly every library got a grant. And that is because the maintenance of support is suspended this year. I think we would have gotten fewer applications had that been the case. The average grant to a library was $5,000. So these aren't large grants, but libraries are able to do really good things with them. The largest grant was $90,316 to the Multnomah County Library. The smallest grant was $53 to, I don't know, what library, probably Agnes or another community like that, Helix. So that gives you a sense of the size of this program. The total grants totaled $597,310 last year.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the panel, and thanks for coming. Nice to see you, BJ. And I'm going to close this public hearing on House Bill 2916 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2917. Kara, would you like to put us in the picture here?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, 2917 committee will look familiar to you because it was before you earlier as Legislative Council draft. I'll remind you that what House Bill 2917 accomplishes is to transfer the authority to manage the unclaimed property program from the Department of State Lands to the State Treasurer. You have people here that can testify a great deal on what all this does, and so I won't take lots of that time since we have had a long meeting today, but would like to remind you that the bill was requested by the State Lands Board, and there is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means on this bill, should you pass it out.
Questions of the committee? Representative Esquivel?
Yes, I think on this, there's another unique operation in the state of Oregon that turns monies over to the state, and that's when you, and it's a client's trust account in a title company. When both parties do not agree to release that, eventually some of the parties leave. You can't find those people. So I think that needs to be included, because I had a situation in Josephine County where we had $246 for 7 years that we couldn't locate an owner. So I think the same process needs to be part of this as well, because that's another bit.
Okay. Well, we will await your discussion on amendments, if you have one forthcoming. At this time, I'd like to invite our state treasurer, Randall Edwards, to come forward. tell us about this bill. He's brought lunch and the.
Yeah, bring a spare ball.
Well, good morning, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon, and thank you very much for having me here to talk to you about something I think is really exciting for the state of Oregon. House Bill 2917 is an opportunity to, I think, improve a program that we have in the state to really begin to elevate a very much needed program in Oregon to help the citizens of the state as well as help our schools. The bill before you is a bill that was coming from you by the State Land Board, which I'm a member, as well as the Governor and Secretary of State. Simply, this bill is going to transfer for the Oregon's Unclaimed Property Program from the Department of State Land, or DSL, to the State Treasury. This is a good government bill and will result in greater citizen protection and more money for schools. Under this bill, Oregon's program will achieve greater compliance under current law, reunite more Oregonians with their property, and generate more money for schools. Before I talk about the reasons behind this bill, I'd first like to briefly describe what unclaimed property is. Following my testimony, Ann Hannes and Cindy Wickham of DSL will give you more information about the history and the operation of this program. Unclaimed property is simply property such as bank accounts, paychecks, securities, safety deposit box contents, that have been dormant for a certain period of time and have not been claimed by the rightful owner. So I brought you some examples of what unclaimed property can look like. It is not a sandwich, although that could be, I suppose, left in somebody's safety deposit box. Here's an example, a baseball, an autographed baseball. We have those as part of the unclaimed property program. Jewelry is part of the unclaimed property program. Dentures are part of the unclaimed property program. We have a room in the state land division that is full of a variety of contents, which, again, Ann Hannes and Cindy can give you more detail about, but those are the things that we collect and then sell off and hold that money on behalf of a beneficiary forever. Every state in the country has an unclaimed property program, including the District of Columbia. The primary purpose of these programs is simple. It is to reunite people with their property. Holders of unclaimed property, businesses, and governmental entities are required by law after a specific time to transfer all unclaimed property to the state for safekeeping. In Oregon, the state holds unclaimed property for perpetuity on behalf of the rightful owner without ever taking title to it. The state searches for the property's rightful owner and returns the property to them. While the state holds the property, the proceeds are part of the common school fund, and the investment income off these proceeds are used to pay the expenses of administering the program and are distributed to the K-12 system twice each year. To give you a sense of the size of the unclaimed property program in Oregon, the Common School Fund contains just under $200 million in unclaimed property. For fiscal year 2004, Oregon collected nearly $30 million in unclaimed property and returned over $8 million to its rightful owners. Over the past several years, it has been a trend nationally to house unclaimed property programs in treasurer's offices. This is because unclaimed property programs are essentially financial management programs, and by placing them in offices like mine, they reap the benefits of the financial management expertise found in treasuries. 33 treasuries now house their unclaimed property programs, or have titled the unclaimed property programs. On a national level, the National Association of Unclaimed Property Administrators is affiliated with the National Association of State Treasurers. Yes, we do have an association for every aspect of government, and this is another one. But this has given treasurers and unclaimed property programs a coordinated effort to influence national issues affecting unclaimed property. By moving the program to my office, Oregon's program will achieve some of the same benefits that have been achieved across the country. Benefits such as greater accountability, greater government efficiency, better citizen protection, more money for schools, and, as I mentioned, greater influence over national policy. One of the biggest challenges facing this program is making both the holder and the rightful owner aware of their existence of their program, of this program and their property. And in preparation for this hearing today, we actually ran to see if any of you, any of the members of this committee had any unclaimed property. I'm sorry, Chair Berger, but you came up empty at this point, which maybe somebody in the past, you already got your money. There was one Sumner, Macon Sumner, who had $50 of value in the unclaimed property program. I don't know if that's a distant relative, Representative Sumner, but anyway, perhaps we struck out with the committee. But the point is, there are thousands of people who have unclaimed property that we're holding on their behalf, and a key element of the success of this program is to publicize and elevate this program to the citizens so that they have an opportunity to claim this $50 or the money that they have. By housing the unclaimed property program in the office of a single statewide elected official provides direct accountability to the citizens for returning their property to them and for helping agencies and businesses comply with state law. In talking with many of my colleagues around the country about their experiences with bringing in the unclaimed property program, I know that through greater visibility and accountability, Oregon's program will be successful, even more successful. Greater visibility and increased compliance with current law will result in the collection of more unclaimed property and the return of property to the rightful owners. But because the program can never be 100% efficient, that is, finding all the rightful owners, we will also see an increase in the Common School Fund and more money to schools. Federal legislation, multi-state agreements, and corporate consolidations will significantly impact unclaimed property programs around the country. With the program in my office, Oregon will have more influence over policy at a national level to protect the interests of our citizens. For example, the National Association of State Treasurers and the National Association of Unclaimed Property Administrators are working together on federal legislation that would help the states reunite its citizens with matured, unredeemed U.S. savings bonds being held at the Treasury. The U.S. Treasury, not my Treasury. Okay. This is millions of dollars of Oregon's money, and Oregonians should have a stronger voice in these negotiations. We have a good program in Oregon. We just want to make it better. That's why the Land Board has brought you this bill. My office does hold and manage billions of dollars in assets on behalf of others, and unclaimed property would be no different. Moving this program will make it stronger. This is a win-win proposition. We will achieve greater compliance with current law, increasing asset collection. We will reunite more Oregonians with their property, and we will generate more money for schools. This is a good bill for Oregon and Oregonians. Because transferring the program from one agency to another is somewhat complicated, I'm finding this out very quickly how complicated it is to move a single program to another agency, we have amendments to the bill before you, which they will be forthcoming. But this has been a project that the Land Board has taken on. We believe it's a good piece of improvement in our government, a good program that we want to enhance to make it better. It follows a national trend that has happened across the country to moving these programs underneath the Treasury or Treasurer, and I believe this is a good bill for Oregon. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you.
Treasurer Edwards, thank you very much for being here. Before we entertain questions from the panel, I have two comments. One, an apology for my nonverbal signal when you mentioned the National Association of Unclaimed Property Administrators. I can visualize their national convention, that fun-loving group. And it popped into my head, and I did not mean to be disrespectful, because clearly there would be such an organization. The other thing I would like to comment on is that it was real close when you went on that search for me, because subsequent to the committee submitting this particular bill to the committee as a committee bill, I got a letter from my credit union saying that I had an account that had been inactive for some undetermined amount of time, and had I forgotten about it, and if I hadn't, the money was going to go to unclaimed property. And at some point, I would like someone to explain to me what would have happened then if they hadn't sent me that letter, or I hadn't received that letter, or we hadn't gotten that conversation. It was a very small amount, and I'm curious the steps that would have been taken to try and find me had my money and I been separated. But I can assure you that that rarely happens. I knew all about that account. So, it was close. You almost had me. Questions from the panel? Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Treasurer Edwards, the process of moving from one department, are there staff people that will go into your department now?
And thank you for the question, Madam Chair. Representative Buckley, we're physically going to take the 12 people that run the program and move them into my office. So physically, nothing's changing. Nothing's changing in the size of the program. We're just moving it into the Treasury, which... the benefits we see, as I described, not only are you putting it within my office, but you're also getting the advantage of having, we have our own IT department, for example. We have more support we can give them. We have an internal auditing function that we can bring to this. We'll probably house it in my banking division, which is pretty common. So it's a good alignment. And again, I think we've seen across the country when those alignments have been made, there has been a greater improvement in the program.
Paul?
Yes.
Thank you. Is there any change in the collective bargaining agreement with those 12 employees that will be shifted over?
No.
Okay, one last follow-up?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In terms of the high-tech support, is there currently a mechanism now that you said you ran a program on our committee? If I went to a website, could I type in my name and see if there's anything registered?
Yes, you may, Madam Chair. Representative Buckley, yes, you may. The other thing is, which is a national issue, of course, is you may have property elsewhere. In fact, my parents were contacted. There are businesses out there who are trying to match you with your property in other states. So there are very sophisticated programs to try to track down people and match their property with them. This is one where I think technology has been a big help. And having publicity is really the way in which you try to get awareness of the program, so you're not just getting the letter. In essence, what you described, Madam Chair, is one of the things. The first call line is the people who have your property should be contacting you. But as you know, people move, people pass along, therefore this property becomes dormant, and then ultimately it comes back to us in a very short period of time, which then we liquidate and try to find that rightful owner. So that's really the essence of the program. Technology's helped. My IT department is very excited about helping enhance this program, and I think we've got the capability of doing that.
Thank you. I'm going to... Yes, Representative Sumner.
Who do I see about getting my 50 bucks?
They're coming up behind me.
All right. And I'm going to welcome Ann Hannes and Cindy Wickham.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Treasurer, for coming forward.
I was going to put the jewelry on, but I didn't know if that would be appropriate.
There are some who would be more interested in the baseball, certainly.
Madam Chair, if it's a Babe Ruth baseball, it's probably on me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for your patience in waiting in the back of the room, and we've had a long day of testimony. I've noted you found it.
Good morning, Chair Berger, members of the committee. My name is Ann Hannes. I'm director of the Department of State Lands, and with me is Cindy Wickham, who is the manager of the Unclaimed Property Program. I'd like to just start with a brief historical overview of the program. It really dates back to British common law when abandoned property was given to the king, and then we used that same common law when our country was founded, and it eventually evolved to applying only to intangible personal property. So most states don't take permanent title to the property, but they hold it in trust for the rightful owners and basically act as custodians for safeguarding it. In 1954, there was a conference of commissioners of uniform state laws, and out of that conference came the Uniform Unclaimed Property Act, and we currently use that Unclaimed Property Act here in Oregon. As Treasurer Edwards mentioned, there are three goals to the program. One is that we want to find the rightful owner and reunite that rightful owner to the property that they have. The second one is to protect businesses from subsequent claims after the property is remitted to the state. And the third is to ensure that any economic windfall from these unclaimed properties for the benefit of our public schools. We have 12 employees in the unclaimed property program, and they are responsible for processing Oregon's unclaimed property. They inventory safe deposit boxes. They reconcile the reports of stocks, mutual funds, and cash to the receipts. They review inquiries and document ownership from individuals. They also audit businesses for unclaimed property, and they hold auctions of tangible property. For example, about a week ago, we had an auction which included a baseball. For example, one was, I think, autographed by Ty Cobb, and we get all kinds of really interesting things.
Stop it.
jewelry and coins, and that raised over $100,000 for schools. And we also then have education and outreach through a variety of medium. You'll see that there are charts in your book under tab 5 that shows the number of reports and claims that have been processed since 1990. As Treasurer Edwards mentioned, it's not a small amount of money. In 2004, we received nearly $30 million in unclaimed property receipts and distributed $8 million in claims. One of the things that I'm especially proud of staff is that we've made great strides in developing internal controls and processing efficiencies that have allowed us to address the growth in the program with the current level of staff. I'm really proud of the work that they've done, and I know that the work that they're going to do at the Treasurer will make this an even better program and that they'll continue to perform very highly. Moving the program to Treasury makes sense because we're aiming to enhance the Common School Fund over the long term. The Department of State Lands is focusing on land management and conservation issues as they relate to the Common School Fund, the state's natural resources, and the needs of our citizens and schools. And I think the Treasurer is going to provide leadership, particularly at the state and federal levels, to increase visibility and deal with emerging issues. One issue, for example, as we have more corporations that are no longer based in Oregon, we've had situations where unclaimed property from payroll may go to the state of the incorporation of that corporation where they might have stayed here. So another state gets that windfall. It's much harder for an Oregon citizen to be able to try to find their property, say, in Ohio, because they may not know that the corporation is now in Ohio. And as a result, I think it's a lose for the citizens of our state and for the schools of our state. And that's one where I believe the Treasurer can take a strong leadership role in. So I'd like to wrap this up and be available to answer questions. Cindy is the one who has been doing an incredible job over the last couple years as the manager, and I think it's with her leadership and a great staff that you can see how the numbers have been over the last couple years, and I think that's a trend that's going to continue upward.
Thank you. Cindy, are you going to make remarks?
No.
Okay. So then I was going to wait until after you're done, and then questions from the panel. The state lands folks.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
For your testimony, Mike Currier is next. Is he here? Okay. Then let's bring Chuck Bennett and John Marshall up. Or whoever. Andy Jordan. Sorry, Andy.
Okay. Whoever.
She was coming anyway.
Well, Chuck Bennett's name, COSA, and then Andy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Boards Association. Mr. Bennett had another commitment, so Ms. Jordan from the Oregon PTA and I will express the views of the Common School Fund Beneficiaries Coalition. This is a group of the usual K-12 suspects that have been involved with Director Hannes and the Department of State Lands in an attempt to try to become, one, more aware of the value of the Common School Fund, and two, we've established ourselves for the purpose of the preservation, protection, and defense of the Common School Fund and all of its sources of revenue. We've come to realize that the Common School Fund has the potential for creating an even more significant contribution to K-12 school funding. We're approaching the point where the corpus of the Common School Fund, that is this trust that's held in perpetuity for the benefit of not only children in Oregon public schools today, but for generations to come, is approaching $1 billion. And the earnings on that fund are distributed annually or semi-annually to school districts and is beginning to contribute more and more to the costs of operating our schools. And we believe that there are opportunities to enhance the revenue into that fund to not only help schools next year and the year after, but, as I said, for generations to come. Prior to the beginning of the legislative session, we and our beneficiaries coalition were brought in to the Department of State Lands, where we were had a chance to review this idea, listen to the treasurer and his ideas, and other members of the land board, as they believe that this proposal has the potential of not only reuniting individuals with their property, but also enhancing the benefits to the Common School Fund. As Treasurer Edwards suggested, the proposal contained in House Bill 2917 provides for greater accountability, greater government efficiency, better citizen protection, greater influence over national policy, and more money for schools. Did I mention more money for schools? And we believe that this is a good move and would encourage you to take a look at the technical amendments proposed and move it on to the Joint Ways and Means Committee, where this issue can be considered in the context of their prioritization over the Treasurer's programs as well as the Department of State Lands budget. With that, Madam Chair, I'd be glad to respond to any questions.
Questions? We've another new organization, Common School Fund Beneficiaries Coalition.
They are the same kind as the association.
I'm sure that they are equally exciting.
I think we have a little more fun at our conventions.
Ms. Jordan, did you have remarks?
I don't have any further to say. But we're just very supportive of anything that will improve, protect, or benefit the Common School Fund.
And we appreciate you coming down to ditto that. Okay. Thank you very much. I have one more name here, Jesse Cornett.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jesse Cornett. I'm both a legislative liaison and state land board assistant for Secretary of State Bill Bradbury. Here today also to testify in support of House Bill 2917. Our office believes that House Bill 2917's passage would be a great benefit to Oregon by increasing the visibility of Oregon's unclaimed property program. It would serve the dual roles of helping to return property to its rightful owners and getting additional dollars into the classroom. There are numerous other reasons why we agree this idea is great, including increased accountability and government efficiency. Oregon's unclaimed property program has proven its success in the Department of State Lands. The treasurer is a proven money manager, and we think this move will make the program even stronger. So I would urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you for coming down. Appreciate all the testimony today and your patience. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3067. And as indicated in our agenda, I would like to open public hearing and possible work session on 2094 and remind the panel that this is a proposal to authorize agencies to offer extended term licenses, which we heard a long time ago. There is still work sort of ongoing, and we are now awaiting a revenue report on this, so it is my intent to carry this over to Thursday, and we will work on it Thursday morning at our Thursday morning meeting. So with that, I will close this
public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2094, and open, now that the room is completely empty, a work session on House Joint Resolution 16, and remind you that we heard testimony on this last week, and I'm about to vote it, Representative Esquivel.
You didn't miss a yes, but it...
That doesn't count. That does not count, Representative. And if you recall, Carrie, you want to remind us about this?
Yes, I will. Very quickly, that reminds you that House Joint Resolution 16 was brought to you by Representative Lim, suggesting that we name the Lunar New Year as Oregon's Asian American Day.
We are in work session. I would entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move H.J.R. 16 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Sumner moves H.J.R. 16 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any objection? So ordered. Thank you. And I will ask Representative Lim, who could not be here this morning but wanted to be, to carry this bill on the floor on behalf of the committee with no objection. Thank you very much. And I'm closing the work session on H.J.R. 16 and closing this committee meeting of the House General Committee, adjourning House General Government Committee. And thank you all for your patience. It's been a long morning, and we'll see you Thursday morning.